Hello, Vet Blast podcast listeners. Did you notice you can earn 0.25 CE credits with this podcast? After listening to this podcast, head on over to dvm360.com/flex and then sign in or register for a free account. Then select the podcast and follow the online prompts to claim your CE.
Hello and welcome to the Vet Blast podcast. I am your host, Dr. Adam Christman, Chief Veterinary Officer here at Fetch DVM 360. Hey, everybody, welcome back to the Vet Blast podcast. We want to thank our friends from Elanco for sponsoring this wonderful episode, and we're going to press pause on the parvo panic. That's right. So much to talk about parvovirus, and joining us is the one and only Dr. Brian DeGangi. How are you, my friend?
I'm well. Hi, Dr. Christman. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Thanks for being here. And this is a race-approved podcast that we have here to our listeners. So go ahead and get your education on and a little bit of information about our wonderful friend, Dr. DeGangi. He is a clinical associate professor of shelter medicine with the Veterinary Community Outreach Program at the University of Florida. You got to do the
Gators. Go.
After earning his DVM at the University of Florida in 2006, Dr. DeGangi completed a rotating internship in small animal medicine, surgery, and critical care, a residency in shelter animal medicine, and received his MS in veterinary medical sciences in 2010. Dr. DeGangi has published peer-reviewed research on canine heartworm diseases, veterinary field clinics, feline adoption, pregnancy detection, and immunology, and authored textbook chapters on sanitation and asepsis, infectious disease management, animal welfare, and animal relocation. He is the lead editor of the second edition of Animal Behavior for Shelter Veterinarians and Staff, and is board certified in both canine and feline practice and shelter medicine practice by the American Board of Veterinary Practitioners. Dr. DeGangi has served terms on the executive boards for both the Association of Shelter Veterinarians and the American Heartworm Society. Prior to rejoining the University of Florida, Dr. DeGangi worked as a senior director of shelter medicine for the ASPCA, providing consultation support for over, get this, 180 animal shelters nationwide engaged in animal transportation and relocation efforts. That's fantastic. Great work, my friend. My goodness.
Thank you.
Really great work. We need that in this profession. We really do. I'm so glad that you're doing great work like that. You know, you're in shelter medicine and about infectious disease. So as a shelter professional, you see definitely a fair amount of infectious diseases. So how common is canine parvovirus in the shelter environment?
For sure. Infectious diseases is, you know, our number one thing that we're always vigilant about, and our mind is geared towards that. So, you know, parvovirus, I think the best answer is it's very common. It's everywhere. It varies by shelter model, by region of the country that you're in, by the season, but we still see it everywhere. And I think that's something that many private practitioners who, you know, may not interact with shelter populations in their areas may be surprised to hear, because it's, you know, it is a preventable disease and we have tools to deal with it. But we see it all the time in shelters. And there's a lot of reasons for that. It can survive in very harsh environments. We have a lot of animals coming in from unknown backgrounds, and they probably don't have a lot of veterinary care in their history. You know, somewhere between 60-75% of animals entering shelters are stray. So we don't really know what their background is, and probably didn't have a good vaccination history to prevent them from getting infected. So a lot of them are at risk. In fact, there was a study done in Florida a few years back looking at protective antibody titers in shelter dogs that came in, and about a third of them were protected against parvo. So two-thirds were not. So that'll give you some idea of how prevalent it might be in our shelter populations.
Wow. I know I still continue to work in shelter medicine, and it is a problem here in New Jersey, on the East Coast at least too. So yeah, it's a problem everywhere. Let's talk about the impact of what this means, because it certainly causes an impact on shelters and the team. So what's the impact of canine parvovirus on animal shelters?
The word that comes to mind is it's a strain. It strains all portions of the system. Of course, there's, you know, a financial component to it, and there's costs associated with treating disease, generally higher than would be for disease prevention. So there's money that gets spent on treating parvovirus and any disease, but there's also limited resources in as far as the facilities go. As far as the staff, both number and training and level of knowledge and skill, and then time. If we're spending a lot of time treating disease, time that is taken away from the rest of the population and the other services that the shelter may want to provide. So it's a strain on the operation from no matter which way you look at it.
I also think of like the work culture as well. I mean, when you have just a parvo that runs rampant through the shelter, and I know maybe to the listeners, I'm sure you can relate. It really does affect your morale. The you worry about going home to your own pets, right? So have you noticed that as well, how it affects work culture?
Yeah, that's a really important point. I mean, these cases, as folks know, have treated them in individual pet scenarios. They really require intensive care, and they're really weigh on those of us that are caring for these animals, you know, multiple hours a day. And so imagine that in a shelter setting where there's likely multiple animals affected or an entire litter of puppies that are affected. And so that certainly weighs on folks. I've seen it lead to frustration, just like we have in other areas of practice, because it's a preventable disease. And so we see these cases coming in and we're just kind of a little bit helpless into how we can make it better and take care of those animals. I think there's a whole other sort of level of concern that goes into cases where there might be in shelter transmission or in shelter spread of the disease too. There might be some guilt associated with that. Helplessness felt by the shelter staff when they sort of recognize that maybe some of the things that they're doing could be contributing to the disease as well. And they're struggling to care for all these animals and more keep coming in, yet their resources don't change. So it really does impact the culture of the work environment and our ability to serve our mission and to serve other animals in the population and in the community if we're focused on treating disease in individuals.
Yeah, absolutely. I just know that it puts such a strain on the team overall. And, you know, as parvo affects young, typically unvaccinated or under-vaccinated dogs, what are some common co-infections that you see with canine parvovirus cases?
Yeah, I think this is probably similar to what you might expect to see in private practice. So we're always concerned about intestinal parasites, hookworms, roundworms, potentially whipworms as well as being co-infections and worsening the severity of disease or worsening the prognosis for those individual animals. I think the other thing that we're also concerned about, and as you alluded to, if they're under vaccinated, they're probably at a high risk for canine distemper in particular, as well as some of the other respiratory diseases. But of course, canine distemper is going to have the most severe impact on the animals and the severe threat to the rest of the population in the shelter as well. So the consequences can be really dire if we have unvaccinated dogs in the population. So of course, worried about the GI tract and their ability to heal and respond to that. But those other vaccine preventable diseases are also top concern in these scenarios.
Yeah, absolutely. These comorbidities that can happen. And let's pivot a little bit and talk about current treatment. Currently, what does current treatment of canine parvovirus look like in the shelter setting?
Yeah, I think it can look like a lot of different things, just given the variation in sheltering models that are out there and the different resources that are available. And so it's not uncommon to see shelters that are treating patients just like you would in a hospital setting with inpatient care and IV fluid therapy, you know, near around the clock, if not around the clock, monitoring and support. But then we also see a lot of outpatient-based protocols where animals are treated with, you know, subcutaneous fluids, frequent monitoring and returning. Maybe they're at a foster home, or if they might be a privately owned pet, so you can care at a wellness clinic. Maybe they're returning for monitoring and care on an outpatient basis. And then, you know, various combinations thereof, given the resources that are in place. And so it can look like a lot of different things. And one of the factors that impacts that is the level of veterinary support that is available, because that varies tremendously as well for different shelters. So you might have an in-house veterinarian, you might have a veterinarian that's just contracted to provide services for the shelter, or maybe you're a shelter that's utilizing private practice in town for all your veterinary care needs. And so how those cases are handled is going to vary based on that.
Absolutely. Well, what about the individual parvo cases in the shelters? How can, you know, the shelters prevent individual parvo cases from becoming, of course, an outbreak?
This is an important question, because that's always the big fear. These cases are probably inevitably going to come into the shelter. And so we need to make sure that they're isolated, they're cared for, and we don't contribute to any further spread. We certainly don't want animals to be getting sick while they're in shelter care. because of some of the operational things that we may or have done or have not done. So I think there's two things that are really critical for me when trying to help shelters prevent an individual case from becoming an outbreak. And one is to have really good isolation protocols and make sure that you have a mechanism for identifying sick animals and getting them out of the general healthy population. And I think a lot of people hear that and they look at their facilities and resources and go, oh, no, we can't do that. One of the things that I try to convey is that isolation can be done in a variety of different ways. It's really just about physically preventing the spread of, you know, in this case, parvovirus from traveling from one animal to the other. And so if you have a designated isolation ward or facility that's separate from the rest, that's great. Many shelters don't have that. And so you could operationally isolate an animal in a shelter, and you might have a designated row of kennels that becomes your isolation space. You might have a specific kennel that the animal is in. Maybe it just becomes isolated in its own kennel, and it really comes down to the way that you handle those cases operationally, making sure that there's really clear protocols for personal protective equipment, who is handling those animals, what sort of cleaning supplies and equipment are going in and out of those areas. And so it can look like a lot of different things, but the key is that we don't want to have known sick animals exhibiting vomiting and diarrhea, sitting in the general population, intermixing with healthy animals. Right. The second sort of piece of that, I guess I would say, is a little bit of overlap, but is looking at just general traffic flow around the facility, general biosecurity. So how are animals and people moving through? Are there practices and protocols in place that are contributing to the potential for disease spread, as well as looking at your sanitation protocols and making sure they're actually effective for killing parvovirus, which we know is one of the most hardest viruses to remove from the environment?
I've been chatting with a lot of the hospital design teams, and interestingly enough, from a shelter perspective, as well as for creating newer hospitals, they're really focusing on building, you know, isolation wards moving forward to make sure that that is like an absolute biosecurity must have for these practices and shelters. So I think that's so important these days, right? I mean, considering what we're dealing with from infectious diseases.
Yeah, for sure. That's going to be the easiest way to handle it, keep it contained, and to take care of those animals from an operational perspective. And so if that's available, that works really well.
And let's talk about the outbreak itself. So, you know, let's say we have a parvo outbreak that's happening in the shelter. So what advice do you have for the listeners that have shelters managing parvo outbreaks?
The key here is to stop the spread, whatever it takes to stop the spread of the outbreak from affecting more animals. And so, you know, we want to review the isolation and biosecurity protocols, like I mentioned, to make sure that is happening the way that we expect they're happening. But I think it's also important to sort of go back to basics and look at vaccination protocols in the shelter itself. We know that these can have a huge impact on the ability to acquire and transmit disease, even in the short period of time that the animals are in the shelter. And I think that's a really important one for a few reasons. We commonly see protocols that vary from what we would recommend in shelter medicine practice. And it's noteworthy that they're different than what we'd recommend for privately owned pets in a lower risk scenario. And so we want to see animals get vaccinated earlier, starting at as early as 4 weeks of age. We want them to have boosters every 2 weeks until they're 20 weeks of age, which is much more frequent administration of vaccination than you might do in a privately owned pet who's at generally low risk for acquiring disease. And so it's really important to review those practices when you're in an outbreak situation, even though it might seem like it's not the top priority, but that can really go a long way in helping prevent that disease from spreading. And similarly, looking at how vaccines are handled and administered is also important. I've certainly been involved in outbreaks where the vaccines were stored in a refrigerator that wasn't actually maintaining temperature that was needed to keep those products viable. And so some things like that that you might think of overlooking, or you might not think they're that important, can actually contribute to furthering a disease outbreak that you're dealing with in the moment.
Yeah, that's a really great key. Thank you for sharing that, because sometimes we forget about that one. So we know about traditional care for parvo cases. We've been really focusing as veterinarians. I mean, I can think of for the longest time, I've been always treating for supportive care. I mean, that's what I've been doing. Yeah. And finally, it's very exciting because this is what I love about veterinary medicine and how well we progress. You know, we have something new that's out. So what can you tell us about Elanco's recently approved canine parvovirus monoclonal antibody?
Yeah, so supportive care is super important and has been very successful for many years. But yeah, we are super excited that Elanco has released their canine parvovirus monoclonal antibody, which will we'll probably refer to as CPMA. But the exciting thing about this is it's the first and only treatment that specifically targets the virus itself. And so, you know, all the supportive care efforts that we're doing are important and are helpful, but they're supportive care and they're secondary. And so this treatment will specifically target the virus. And what we found in the efficacy studies were that animals that were treated with the CPMA product had significantly shorter time to resolution of vomiting, lethargy, and inappetence. And so we're talking like 2 to 3 days shorter, depending on which parameter that you're looking at. And when you first hear that, you go, okay, that's great. There's some effect of the product. And then you sort of think about the impact of that. You know, vomiting and inappetence are what keep these puppies in the hospital or keep them stuck in the sick ward of a shelter. And so that's a huge deal that we can get them over those signs quicker and get them home sooner and get them out into the adoption population where we want them to be and to move on and to move out of the shelter system in our case. I think the other really kind of key thing about the CPMA product and the efficacy studies that were done is that there were no deaths in any of the puppies that received treatment versus 4 out of 7 deaths in puppies that were treated with the placebo in the efficacy studies. And so we know it works. It works really well and has a significant impact on the way those puppies are feeling and how we can manage them in the shelter environment.
Yeah, that's impressive. That really is. So I know we as veterinarians, we're scientists. We want to know, how does CPMA work and how may it change our parvo treatments?
As we described in the name, it's a monoclonal antibody. And so it's administered as a single intravenous dose. We want to give it as early on in the disease course as possible. The efficacy studies were done early on in the disease course, so we know the best about its effects when given in that way. And what it does is the antibody is just like antibodies produced by our own immune system. It binds to the virus and prevents the virus from entering the host cell. And so basically stops that infection in its tracks. Efficacy studies earlier in administration of this one dose of product. And it's important to also say that in these studies, no other supportive care measures were given to these puppies. And so we're obviously going to still continue to do that in clinical practice, but it's really exciting to think about how much effect the product had in puppies that received only this treatment. And we're going to be able to provide this in addition to some of the other things that we know are really important. So it's going to make our role in treating and managing these cases a lot easier as well.
Like a lot easier, I think. Emphasize, I think, absolutely. I think it's a game changer, in my honest opinion.
Right.
I mean, so canine parvovirus monoclonal antibody or CPMA, I understand that it's been shipped to some customers already. So, do you have any early feedback or recommendations on how shelters are implementing CPMA into their parvo treatment protocols?
Yeah, I reached out to a bunch of my colleagues. Everyone is super excited about the potential and incorporating the product into their work and into their shelters. No one I've talked to has used it yet. A couple folks have received it, and they haven't had any cases to try it out on in the last few days. But everyone is excited about the potential, and I've talked to them a little bit about sort of how they're planning on using it. And I think what we're seeing here is a variety of different ways of using the product as well. Again, going back to the different resources available at each shelter. And so one shelter I talked to was planning on using it in every case that was diagnosed with parvovirus, while others were thinking about really reserving it for cases that they consider to be at higher risk for severe disease or a poor outcome. So sort of tailoring which patients were a best fit for them and within their resource budgets. And I think the other thing that our field is excited about is many shelters also have community clinics associated with them, and shelter vets are also working with those pets and those clients. And so this offers another tool in the toolbox to be able to offer to those client-owned pets to helpfully prevent them from having to relinquish a pet and take it into the shelter in the first place. They can maybe treat it more easily, offer them another treatment option while they're still in the home.
I think that's huge. That's huge, huge, huge. You know, what I was thinking of as well, Brian, when I was treating, you know, parvo cases, these puppies that were, you know, they overcome it, but behaviorally, they had some issues because of the fact that they were isolated during that key crucial moment, as you know, for enrichment and so forth. And so when I heard this was coming out, I said, oh my gosh, not only is it great for them, for their health, but I also think that behavior, the human animal bond and being the ability to be with the pet parent is going to be so, so crucial. I was just curious to get your thoughts on that too.
Yeah, that's a really important point. And yeah, you're right on that. The puppies that are most at risk for severe disease and for prolonged hospitalization are the ones that are right in that sensitive period of socialization. And so right at the time we need them to be out there and learning about the world and meeting people and other animals and learning all these new things, we've got them isolated in a cage or kennel in a hospital or a clinic. And so again, I go back to like, this product will allow us to shorten the amount of time that we need to keep them in those conditions and get them back out into a more natural environment and hopefully promote healthier socialization of these young animals through the process.
Yeah, absolutely. And then from a shelter perspective, what does a new therapy such as CPMA mean for shelters managing parvo outbreaks?
I mean, I think the same as it means for everybody, but I think it, you know, one word that comes to mind to me is hope. I've talked to a number of shelters that are just in the midst of an outbreak and they just don't know what to do. And they're trying so hard and they've expended all their resources and more animals are coming in and more animals are getting sick and they just kind of can't get a foothold on it. And there are only a limited number of options that we can give them. And it's really great to be able to give them something else that we know can be effective and that can really reduce the burden on the caregivers. The animals feel better more quickly. And, you know, we talked about the benefits to the animals and sort of the shelter. We talk a lot in shelter medicine about reducing length of stay and getting the animals through the system as quickly as possible. And this is just another tool that we can use to help do that, because that's ultimately how we serve more animals, serve more pet owners, and are able to fulfill our missions as shelters and conduct all the services we want to in the way that we want to and ultimately save more lives. So moving animals through the shelter more quickly using whatever tools are available to us is always going to be a good thing.
Yes. We just talked earlier about work culture, especially in the shelter perspective, how it can be very daunting. I just read somebody's post yesterday of a veterinary technician that's leaving because she could not take the sadness of euthanasias and so forth anymore. So when I hear something like this that's coming out to change, to literally affect and improve a great outcome for puppies and dogs in general with parvovirus, I think of what the impact that this is going to be on both veterinary hospitals and shelters. Do you feel the same way?
Yeah, I agree. I think there's just so much potential and people are really clamoring for something new and something effective to try that, you know, is really easy. One intravenous dose and it's kind of incredible to think about the potential that a product like this could have.
Absolutely. I will tell you, when we posted this on the press release came out from Elanco earlier, it was our highest engaged post that we had. And the comments from the profession were just saying, finally, you know, oh my gosh, game changer. Right. And again, I feel like this gives us hope to those that are continually practicing and you feel kind of stuck with the current treatment protocols that are out there. This is something that is exciting and opportunity to really do what we're meant to do and be great veterinary professionals.
Exactly. Yep. Just one more tool in the toolbox.
Bring on the tools. We need them. Well, Dr. Brian DeGaggi, thank you so much for being on the podcast. This is fantastic.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
You're welcome. And thank you to our friends at Elanco again for sponsoring this great, fantastic episode. And don't forget to rate this episode as always here at the Vet Blast Podcast. Continue to do great work out there. And we'll see you next time right here on the Vet Blast Podcast. Take care, everybody. Thank you for listening to the Vet Blast Podcast with me, Dr. Adam Christman. Tune in next time. Remember, take care of your animals and always stay pawsome.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to claim your CE credit hour for listening to this podcast via dvm360.com/flex, where you can register or log into your free account. Then select the CE podcast and follow the online prompts. We hope you enjoyed this episode. And we hope to see you soon. And remember to always stay pawsome.